this week's episode, join me and my wonderful co-star, Rachel, as she tells me an epic tale of the perineal bundles, the research behind it, the research that's missing, the answers we're waiting for, and much, much more, than I could have ever imagined. So stay tuned for this episode. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. The story of perineal bungles. So today, Rachel, you are going to tell me a story, and I am going to sit here with my cup of tea and gladly listen to the story that I yet don't know of, which is wonderful. So great. Go for it. Over to you, storyteller.
Okay. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, when women gave birth. You're listening. Don't laugh at me.
Okay.
Without medical support and surrounded by other women. So, women have perineums and babies come out of vaginas, which
indeed
are in the perineum. See, you're learning so many new things today, Katie.
Oh my God. This is crazy. Hold on. I need to go back to Midwifery 101. I need to go back to the first episode.
So, if anybody has experienced, or I guess even seen, a baby coming through a woman's vagina, it's kind of, I know some women find it, you know, orgasmic and amazing, but a lot of women find it like really knacks.
It re-knacks, man. I mean, I would love to be able to have a power. Like, what would be your superhero power? I can give everyone an orgasmic birth, but also they don't feel embarrassed about it. That would be pretty awesome. Can you imagine the different noises in the labor ward? I said labor ward.
Well,
in the birthing suite. Actually, it'd be the same,
I think. It sounds pretty similar because it's the same hormones, the same anatomy.
It does.
And the same kind of muscles that contract during orgasm that ease the baby out in a physiological birth. If women aren't being told to push at that point where they hold back, it's like that kind of pulsatile orgasmic muscle.
Yeah. I suddenly realized from all those years ago, it's like, actually, that's the same noise. What am I talking about here?
Anyway, back to perineums.
It's just if they had the same feeling. Sorry, I like talking about orgasms. Carry on,
you
perineums.
Have an orgasm later, listen to the story.
Sorry, okay. Storyteller. Please continue.
So, there's been lots of ways that women have tried to ease the stretch of birthing a baby. Way, way back. And what seems really common throughout history is the use of warm oil and compresses. And this varies kind of across the globe and across cultures, depending on the kind of culture, depends on the type of oil and what compresses are used. So in ancient Greece, it was olive oil, of course. And in Victorian England, it was hog's grease and butter.
So like pig fat.
Pig fat and butter.
Maybe the butter. Hog's grease sounds even better. God, us Brits, we did know how to have fun.
I love our rituals. It was awesome. So in the 1900s, so we're telling a story, okay? So in the 1900s, things started to change because birth had moved, remember way back to our first podcast, birth had moved into the hospital. It was now being seen as kind of the woman's body as a machine pushing a baby out, and it needed medicine and intervention to, you know, mitigate the dangers of this machine that didn't work very well. So there's an obstetrician called Ralph Pomeroy who referred to the baby's head as a battering ram, wherewith wherewith to shatter a resisting outlet. Why not open the gates and close them after the procession has passed? So what he advocated was that to save the perineum, obstetricians should cut and reconstruct the perineum for every first birth.
That's where it stems from.
And then that idea of the head, baby's head being a battering ram actually made it into William's obstetrics textbooks throughout the 1900s. So, you know, it's fairly...
Wow.
And I've heard obstetricians say that.
Really? Oh, my God, we're still using those words. I mean, that's true. I mean, when I will talk about breastfeeding, there's still words that we're using, the vernacular from early 1900s, late 1800s.
Ooh. So what we saw in the 1900s was a shift from what was midwifery practice to ease the discomfort of birthing a baby using warm compresses and oils to warm the tissues, help them to stretch and to provide comfort. We saw a shift from that to an attempt to protect the perineum through using surgery. And episiotomy became just routine. So we were cutting perineums to protect them from tearing and then reconstructing them. And that was just common practice. So that kind of went on until the 1980s when there was some research done that pointed out that probably wasn't ideal to cut every woman. And research and there was a midwifery will. I think, you know, midwives had kind of been arguing against doing this, but they were doing it in hospital settings. You know, I was speaking to a midwife recently who trained in the 70s, and she was taught to do an episiotomy for every first-time mother.
Yep, I've spoken to midwives who've also had that experience.
So,
absolutely.
It shifted. Incredible. And, you know, you'll remember when we trained, it was it moved to you do an episiotomy as an emergency procedure for significant fetal distress. That was kind of what we were taught. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, I've only done three, and I actually think two probably shouldn't have been done with hindsight.
Mm.
Mm. So... that's what we had happen in the 1990s. So then we had kind of this whole debate about hands-on, hands-off in the 1990s, where we were taught hands-on. Research was saying it doesn't really make a difference. There wasn't any good evidence to support either way, so it was, you know, a bit of a debate in midwifery, I guess. And the problem where the perineal bungles appeared from was around severe tearing. So that's like third, fourth degree tearings. I'm just going to call them severe tears rather than getting into the technicalities. Mm-hmm. Yep. So for women, so I'll use Australian stats because I guess they're pretty similar across Europe and America and Canada, that kind of across the West where we've got very similar maternity care systems. For women who are having non-instrumental births, the rate of a severe tear is about 2%, so 2.5 in Australia, depends on the setting. So it depends where you're having your baby, basically. And it's as high as 7% for an instrumental birth. So an instrumental birth is pretty risky for the perineum.
Yep.
Now, what we know works, before we get onto the bungles, what we know works in terms of reducing the chance of tearing is actually promoting and supporting physiology, because women who are birthing without directions will protect their own perineum. And I've, you know, I've written about this, so I will link to those writings, because the principles of a nice stretch in the perineum is a slow birth of the baby's head and stretchy tissues. So women instinctively close their legs, which helps the tissues to stretch because they're not under tension by being held apart with their legs wide open. Women instinctively gasp. Once the baby's head's crowning, like a woman who's instinctively birthing is unlikely to go, wah, and welly a big push onto that head because it knacks.
Yes. And then we're taught as as midwives to say keep pushing or directed pushing, but then her instinct is to slow things down. Her body started to slow down those contractions for a reason. Everything's slowing so that it, I'm assuming the perineum is just going to slowly open and allow this baby to come out, and it's in the right time frame for her. I mean, I have to think back so long ago, but it's bringing back those memories of, yeah, of course, women don't just go, ah, or very rarely.
Oh, and, you know, if they are, then that's a time to gently step in and remind them. But if a woman is not being directed, then she tends to not, you know, push when it's really under that amount of pressure. And what happens is she'll hold back and she'll really not push and she'll close her legs and she'll often put her hands on the baby's head to almost try and stop it from coming out. And
oh yes, I remember seeing that.
And then the pelvic floor just does that kind of, you know, those little pulsatile contractions that happen with a orgasm. They just do that and the baby's head just slowly comes out. So that's,
see, we are back to orgasms, Rachel.
Quick, we'll head away from orgasms. So, and actually the clitoris at this point cushions the baby's head. It cushions the back of the baby's head because it's all kind of engorged. Because
I had no idea.
Yeah,
I know it's long, and you know most of the clitoris is inside, and it's this beautiful sort of. I'm holding two fingers up to Rachel as if I'm describing the clitoris going down the back. That is awesome. It's like one of those cushions you have around your head when you go on an aeroplane. That's how I'm imagining it.
Yeah, so the baby pressing on that.
Wow, I never knew that. Yeah.
So it is fairly similar to an orgasm. The baby's pressing on the clitoris and you've got those little pulsatile pushes that get the baby out. So we know that that promotes safe birth for the perineum. And we know that the things that are associated with increasing the chance of tearing or the place of birth, so depending on where...
Of course, that makes sense in my head because of what we know.
Directed pushing increases it because you're interfering with that spontaneous kind of instinct of birth. Syntocin non-induced contractions, because they don't give the body the opportunity to slow things down or stop. They just kind of, they ram the battering ram through the perineum, you know, if we're going to go back to those terminology.
Absolutely. The mum can't sense what's actually happening with her own body because it's not her body really. It is her body that's doing it, but it's not her own hormones that are controlling it. They're not controlling
it. She's not regulating it. And then position. So any position that stretches out the perineum. So, and places.
So all of these putting women's legs in lithotomy, those sort of on your back, open your legs wide. And even as we used to do, you know, putting women's feet on the partner's hip and one on ours. I mean, actually, we
weren't allowed
to do
that.
Thank God, but it was done. And I think it's still done. Luckily, we weren't allowed to do it. But that's a real opening position as well. So that's.
Yeah, it increases your chance of tearing as soon as you kind of stretch. And I tell the students to go home and do their homework around when we're learning about perineums and labor. And try different positions and just feel how much bagginess there is in the back of your perineum, like in the back of your vagina.
Bagginess in my perineum. Hold on. Wait. I mean, I need to go and do some homework. I'm pretty familiar with the vulva, the vagina. I mean, I do make sculptures of them and I'm quite happy to talk about them. But I've never described my perineum as baggy.
That's probably not a good technical word to use. But what...
When
you're thinking about birth positions, anything where there's give, like so there's like some space and some stretchiness in the perineum will reduce the chance of tearing because it allows the perineum to stretch. So, you know, forward leaning, keeping the baby's head from directly pressing on that kind of back on the perineum between the anus and the vagina. So positions basically increase or decrease the chance of tearing.
So which ones are the most beneficial?
Anything where the legs are kind of close together. So, and women will instinctively do it. So squatting is great for getting babies through the pelvis. But once the baby's head starts crowning, it actually increases the chance of tearing because of the perineum so stretched. But what you'll see women do is if they've instinctively got into a squatting position and you're not telling them what to do, they'll throw themselves forward and shut their legs as the baby crowns because it's just too intense.
Oh, right. That's fascinating.
So birthing positions can increase or decrease the risk, and hands-on, so putting your hands on a woman's perineum when she's birthing doesn't make a difference in general, but if it's not her first baby, it increases the chance of a tearing. So I would say it does make a difference because it interferes with her instinct and you're touching her, but let's forget that because that's not research-based. But according to the research, if you put your hands on a woman who's, you know, not having her first baby, then you increase the chance that she'll tear.
Wow. So even for those mums who've gone through it before, yeah, and they're on the second and third, you can that's crazy because it's almost like their body's done it before. Why would it increase? But
yeah, so if you put your hands on, you can.
In my brain, it makes me think that interference is like jolting her out of this sort of this process I'm in, that period right before, as we call transition, or as I knew it, and you're going truly within yourself, and this fear, this expulsion, this listening to instinct, and then somehow someone foreign, so to speak, is touching you in a place where you've probably got a huge amount of concentration. That would be quite jolting to the system to bring you out of yourself.
Yes.
I don't know. As you say, there's no research, but that's what goes through my brain of it. That's what would happen.
The research just says what happens, not why. And it could be, like you say, a range of reasons. It could be because you interfere with. So the birth of a baby is generally quicker when it's not your first. So maybe you're interfering with the woman's instinctive slowing down of the birth. Who knows? Or you could actually be touching her and, you know, making her hold some tension in response to that. Who knows? And then I guess the biggest risk factor is instrumental birth still. So, you know, I have worked with obstetricians who have done some fantastic von Tuss births with intact perineums. You know, they're really skilled clinicians, but, you know, 7% significant tear tells me that there's, you know, there needs to be maybe some improved skills around how to do that.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mum, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. Can I ask, when we talk about instrumental, so if we're talking about von Tuss or vacuum and forceps, is there a difference between the two?
There is a difference. So with a forceps birth, you need more room to get the blood. I'm not an obstetrician, never done one, but this is my understanding. You need more room to put the forceps blades in. So it's usually routine to do an episiotomy. I have seen obstetricians not do an episiotomy for forceps for women who've had babies before. But in general, they'll do an episiotomy to give them room to get the instruments in and properly put around the baby's head to protect the baby's head. Whereas...
Yeah. So then we can't really look at the research looking at the differences between a severe... perineal trauma or severe tearing compared to von Tuss with forceps?
They tend to combine instrumental birth all as one, whereas a von Tuss is very different.
Yes.
And I've often seen obstetricians not do an episiotomy and the woman not even tear during a von Tuss birth. So it's a little bit more traumatic for the baby, But for the mother, her perineum, there's more chance that, you know, it's not going to cause as much damage.
I've also seen that in the limited practice that I had in the birthing suite of very good management with a Ventouse and no need for episiotomy and very minimal tearing at all. But yes, as you say, with forceps, it's routine, or it has been routine wherever I've worked or whoever I've spoken to.
Yes. So no. What happened with the bungles? So what ended up happening was the rates of severe tearing were increasing.
Since when? What are we talking about?
Once they started looking at it, they realized that in certain areas there was a real difference across different hospitals. So some hospitals had like really low rates of tearing, other hospitals had really high rates. So it was inconsistent, and you know, a 7% chance of severe tearing with an instrumental birth is pretty terrible. So that was the problem. Mm. And of course, in the current medical paradigm and way of thinking about things, is that the way that we fix a problem caused by intervention, caused by directed pushing, syntocinon, because we think all those things have been increasing in the last years, the same time as the severe tearing rate has been increasing, so they're associated. So in order to fix a problem that's been caused by intervention, the idea is to do more interventions. So again, that's...
Yep.
But that goes back to our first podcast, which is, you know, we're blaming women's bodies for their tears, not the care provider's actions for the tears. So the entire focus is on the woman.
Yep.
So what happened was, across Europe and in Australia, I'm not sure, I haven't found bungles in America, but or Canada, or
maybe because they don't use the word bungles. Is that your search engine type?
Bungles.
PubMed. Bungles. I'm just looking for some bungles.
So I'm focusing on the Australian one, but there is definitely a bungle in Europe and in the UK. And these are...
Wasn't that a kid's TV show?
No, Rainbow, it was one of the characters.
he was the big bear.
Bungle.
Brilliant.
So what happened was, governments got involved and decided that these rates of perineal tearing were too significant. So there was government-backed initiatives aimed at reducing the increasing rates of severe perineal trauma happening. And the way that these bundles of care, so these are interventions, a whole group of interventions that they decided needed to be put in place to prevent the trauma occurring because of the interventions that were put in place. So they got panels of experts together, mm-hmm. mostly medical professionals, and created intervention bundles, which consisted, interestingly, of interventions that were actually well accepted within hospital settings. So they met the cultural norms of the hospital settings. Then there's training given to staff about how to do them. And then, so in Australia, mm-hmm. there's 28 hospitals that got on board with this. And then they have to monitor mm-hmm. their compliance with doing the interventions, and they monitor the severe tear outcomes, like the rates of severe tear outcomes. Now, I just want to quote Hannah Darlin here before I tell you what the interventions were. So this is Hannah Darlin.
Can you just state who Hannah Darlin is for our listeners if they don't know?
I'm sure they'll know because she's amazing. So Hannah Darlin is a professor of midwifery, and she does amazing research in the space of midwifery, supporting physiological birth, etc. So look her up. She's published hundreds of articles. And this is a quote from Hannah about why the interventions that cause perineal trauma have been left out of the perineal bundles. Because the perineal bundles are all about mm-hmm. doing things to the woman, not stopping doing the things that cause the tearing. So this is what she says. The cascade of intervention in hospital, induction of labor, epidural use, instrumental birth, episiotomy, as a probable cause of higher rates of severe tearing, is often not considered in the obstetric discourse around the issue. Perhaps philosophical frameworks and deeply held beliefs around women's bodies and capacity carry a greater weight at the end of the day than does scientific evidence. Perhaps it is ultimately through this lens of belief around women and birth that we select the evidence, or not, that fits most comfortably with our paradigmatic positioning.
Yep. Wow. Says it all, really, doesn't it?
It sums it up. So what they decided to implement into Australia, and I think it's the same in Europe, is firstly, the midwife has to visualize the perineum in order to do these things, which causes problems in itself, in that, you know, you've got big bright lights on women's perineums, like it's some stage of a performance. Women are encouraged to get into position so you can see what's happening.
Exactly. So then if you're going to have a look, you've got to open that area, which is going against what you've just said.
So the other thing is to apply perineal compresses for all women, which perineal compresses do actually, there's moderate evidence that they reduce the chance of severe tearing.
Is that when the midwife applies, or
well,
when the woman herself applies?
Of course the midwife, because women wouldn't be, you know, applying warm compresses to themselves.
Well, that's why I kind of asked that question. I just wondered your response.
There'd be no reason why they couldn't. So, you know, I don't have a problem with that one. I think offer should be a better word, is offer to all women, because for some women, they really don't want a warm compress put on their perineum when they're birthing their baby. Other women love it. You know, it feels really soothing.
Yeah.
So anecdotal evidence around that component is I am hearing women getting put into positions to facilitate the application of a warm compress.
Right. Okay. So it's sort of counterintuitive, because we're doing something that's got some moderate evidence, but then to enable us to do this, in inverted commas, to the woman, we're then going against the rest of what should be happening physiologically, with the woman instinctively allowing herself at those final stages to get into the positions that are comfortable for her. So we've got this sort of juxtaposition of, we're doing one thing because there's some moderate evidence, but actually we're ignoring the other things that's got strong evidence.
Yeah, and there is no reason to do. You could put a warm compress on a woman in any position. You know, you could help her to hold that against a perineum in any position. And certainly a lot of midwives are doing that, but I'm just hearing, you know, stories of women being told to get onto their back so you can put a compress on. I think there's also confusion about having to visualize the perineum and have a compress on the perineum. And I've heard students getting told off because they're holding a compress on the perineum, but then they're not visualizing it. Like, as if visualize.
Well, how can you visualize it when you've got, I mean, how big is the compress? I'm assuming it's covering the whole perineum. So therefore, like, if it's the size of like a, you know, a pad, a sanitary pad, it's going to pretty much cover the whole of the perineum and the opening and what's going on. So what, I'm confused because I've never used them in my practice. So I'm here like the student midwife or the mom that's listening or the doula, and I'm getting confused by this myself, going, how can I visualize? So you meant to put it on and then take it off?
Maybe,
put it on,
I don't know. I mean, really, watching a perineum is not going to do anything. And if it's tearing, looking at it's not going to stop it. And there's actually nothing you can do to stop a perineum from tearing. I know we think there is. We feel like if we control it, we do something, but there's actually not. So it's just a sense of security. So anyway, so the second thing that we have to do in the bungle is to control the speed of birth by giving verbal instructions and using hands on the baby's head and on the perineum to slow it down. So we're going back to the hands-on stuff and the directed pushing, which
we all know
doesn't reduce the chance of tearing. And for women who've had babies, increases the chance of tearing. And what we also know is that that recommendation goes against Queensland Health, which is an Australian guideline. It contradicts their guidance, which is it states in their, the normal birth guidelines that, you know, hands-on, this is what it, the guideline says, hands-on makes no difference to tearing and increases the chance of an episiotomy, which is correct.
I'm even more confused now. Okay, good job I'm not in the birthing sphere anymore, because I'm going to stick with boobs.
It is confusing. You basically...
Great, carry on. I'm really confused.
So it's not confusing if you just stop trying to make sense of it, right? So you're being told to do something.
Sorry, that goes against everything in human nature. Like, just listen to this and don't be confused. Okay. Right.
It's pretty simple, all right? That in order to prevent someone from having a severe tear, you put your hands on them and direct their pushing, because those things increase the chance of them tearing and increase the chance of them having an episiotomy. Huh? It's all right. What? We're on to number three now.
Great. So it's just going to get better. Brilliant.
So number three is about episiotomies. So when an episiotomy is indicated, it should be done at a minimum of a 60-degree angle from the fourchette, right? Mm-hmm. NB, an episiotomy is indicated for all women having forceps or vacuum-assisted deliveries with their first vaginal birth. Yeah, so they're now telling obstetricians how to do their job, saying all women have to have this thing.
So even vacuum-assisted birth, which we've just talked about how... You know, there's many obstetricians that don't feel the need to do an episiotomy.
Yes. Well, those obstetricians now are expected to do an episiotomy. Never mind their clinical skills or their judgment, they're expected to do an episiotomy. Now, the other thing is, so we know we're going to increase episiotomy rates by doing the hands-on bit, the first, that last point. So if we're going to do one, then a midline, which is, I think they still do this in the US, which is where they cut straight down, that does that increases the chance of severe tearing. Okay, so that's correct. If you're going to do an episiotomy, then you should be doing it at an angle, because then that prevents severe tearing. However, mm-hmm. that takes no account of what you're cutting through at 60 degrees. And now we're heading back to the clitoris.
This is bringing back memories of papers I've recently read.
Yes. So what we are doing at a 60-degree angle is we're cutting through clitoral nerves and structures. And we do have research that shows a decreased sexual functioning and sexual desire, arousal and orgasm within 5 years of having an episiotomy that was cut at 60 degrees.
Oh, God. I've got shivers all over me. I just, wow. And for me, that goes back really to the lack of information and research that really is out there about the clitoris. And even that research, as far as I'm aware, is pretty new about the amount of nerves. And really, we discovered, I'm going to have to look this up, because I'm sure it was the early 90s when they actually really discovered the nerve supply and the system of the clitoris and really how it functions. It's pretty new evidence. Wow.
And it's still not in a lot of textbooks.
No. Oh, my God. Wow, that's just unbelievable and scary and a horrendous thought. I thought I'd just interject and actually update my comments from earlier about the clitoris. Having done a bit more research, I remember and have since found that it is the work of Australian neurologist Dr. Helen O'Connell, who as recently as 2006 highlighted the world to the fact that the clitoris is actually much larger than once thought and really hasn't been represented in the anatomy books properly for a very long time. I'll link all the details to her work in our show notes, so go and check them out. Anyway, back to the show.
So point four is that every woman, regardless of whether a perineum is intact, has to have a rectal examination after birth.
Really? As far as I'm aware, that wasn't the standard unless there was signs of a major tear. They would not be checking rectally.
No. So you used to check, if you'd done suturing, you would check to you know, you'd, with consent, check that you hadn't put any sutures into through the rectum.
Yes.
And if you were, and if you were concerned about a tear, then you would do a rectal examination to see whether or not it had. Yeah. But it wasn't a, if a woman had an intact perineum, and, you know, you've done that, the usual assessment of a perineum, and there are no tears, then you wouldn't be sticking your finger up a bum, right? That's not something.
I mean, it's not very delightful. You think you've gone through the worst of it, and then we do that to you. But what is the, what's the rationale behind that? That we're missing tears, we're missing potential fissures.
So the rationale behind that is that there'll be a extremely small number of women, and I have not, there are no stats for this, that will have a tear that everything's intact and they've just got a tear in the rectum. It doesn't make any sense to me, and I will let an obstetrician answer this one. So Jim Thornton, who's an obstetrician in the UK, this was his response about that intervention. He said, routine rectal examination in the presence of an intact perineum fails all of the criteria of a useful screening test. Most midwives wisely don't do it. Those that do should stop.
Wow. Wow. I've got goosebumps again.
And then the final intervention in the bungle is that all perineal trauma should be basically assessed and graded by an experienced clinician, which I actually agree with. You know, if a woman has perineal trauma, it needs to be assessed and graded, and, you know, as to its severity and repaired if necessary.
But what constitutes as a qualified clinician?
Well, a midwife would be an experienced clinician because we're taught how to assess a perineum. And then if we have any, you know, if we're not sure, we always bring in an obstetrician if we think that it might be a third or fourth, or there's something, it's a significant second degree tear and we want a second opinion.
So that still applies.
Yeah,
we do that. So that hasn't changed. That's what I was asking. Okay.
No, I would hope. Yeah. So I don't know why they've put that in. Maybe some places women aren't getting their perineums assessed. I don't know. So that was the perineal bungle that was implemented into Australia. And I wrote a blog post about it because I was so sick of hearing about it from midwives and students going on and on about how they're being made to do these things to women, and it doesn't seem to fit with evidence, and it's not what they're used to doing. And they're being made to put their hands on babies and women when that isn't how they practice. So I wrote the blog post. And then got a backlash from Women's Health Australasia, which is the Australian organisation that created the bungle. So they released a media response to me. I didn't actually know. I got a message from a very good friend of mine saying, "Have I told you recently that I love you?" And I was like, "Oh, that's nice." And then she sent me a link.
She sandwiched it. She gave you the nice, then the bad. Hopefully she told you she loved you afterwards again.
So I got this media release, and it was a response to Dr. Rachel Reed.
You're kidding.
No.
I can't believe you've never told me about this. Holy moly.
It's on my blog post and you can link to go and read it. So I'm not going to bother reading out what they had to say about Dr. Rachel Reed. They actually took it down and then they put it back up again because I complained and other people complained they'd taken it down and it wasn't very transparent. So they put it back up again, but they took the doctor off. So it's now just response to Rachel Reed.
Oh, so they took away your qualifications.
Yeah, they left it in the main text, but it's not in the heading anymore.
Wow. Wow. I'm speechless, and that's rare.
So in my response to their response, so now we're getting a shit fight. So my response I asked them some questions and asked people to email the questions to WHA. For further information. This is when the bundle first came out, which was 2018. And my response to them, because they basically said that what I'd written wasn't correct and, you know, that people aren't being made to do these things and that it's all great and evidence-based. And they had a panel who all decided on these amazing evidence-based things. No evidence, no references in it. So what I asked was, which members of the expert panel had the final say regarding which interventions were included in the bundle? Were all of the experts in agreement about the final bundle? I asked, could WHA provide a statement from the consumers involved that they approved the final bundle and provide information about whether consumers withdrew from the working party and what proportion withdrew? Next question. WHA state that they are, in quotes, happy to share any of the evidence reviewed by the external panel in the development of the bundle, end quotes. So I asked, could you please share the evidence relating to a hands-on approach for all women during birth and explain why this recommendation contradicts the Queensland Health Normal Birth Guidelines? I also asked, why were other evidence-based approaches that align with clinical guidelines not included in the bundle? For example, spontaneous pushing, encouraging, discouraging particular birth positions. And I also asked, this is my real bugbear here. Will WHA monitor episiotomy rates during this intervention? Anecdotally, midwives and students are reporting increased use of episiotomy during normal birth, particularly for primips. Because what they were doing is they're monitoring severe tear rates. They're not monitoring episiotomy rates.
Oh, gosh. So we're looking at one thing, but completely ignoring something else, which has been shown in the evidence to be to increase with what we're doing, but we're ignoring that fact. And yeah. The ongoing effect of having an episiotomy has a multitude of issues, one of which we've just talked about, which is only just coming to light and seems to be incredibly serious in terms of the impact and long-term impact on sexual function after birth, which is very frightening and very scary and very sad. So we're looking at one thing, but not looking at the other. So what was the response?
Yeah, and what we need to be doing is looking at perineal trauma and looking at it in categories.
Yeah. So that's the umbrella term. And then we can look at what's going on underneath and separate it and try and look at what's caused this so we can learn from it.
Yeah, because a cut, a perineal cut with an episiotomy is a second degree wound. It cuts into muscle. So it needs to be classed as perineal trauma. It is trauma. It's just trauma that's been, you know, enacted by the care provider, not, you know, that hasn't spontaneously happened. And we know that episiotomies don't heal as well as tears. They're more painful than tears. So we actually need to be making sure that that rate is not going up significantly.
Absolutely.
So I asked that, and I didn't get anything back from them. And in the meantime, the marketing of the bungles increased. So, you know, they have all these lovely brochures, which you can see online, and there'll be a link in my blog post, or you can just do a Google search. So they have these lovely brochures, and they always start, and they also present at conferences, and they always start with the women's stories to catch the emotions, because, you know, severe perineal trauma is horrendous. It has life-changing effects for women. It is horrific. Absolutely. And hearing women's stories, you know, makes you want to stop. Oh, we need to, you know, eradicate it. Of course we do. So they always start with that. They've got consumer leaflets that have diagrams of torn perineums, you know, different types of tear. This is for women having babies, just like. Yep. And a list of risk factors on the leaflets, consumer leaflets. And not one of those risks is things that care providers do. Every single one of those risks is at the risk of the woman. Big baby, you know, age of woman. All of the risks are about the woman.
We're blaming our bodies again.
Yeah.
Wow.
No inclusion about the risks of what care providers can do to increase the risk of tearing. Just, you know, these are the risks that you bring with you for your perineum tearing. And I don't know how you can measure compliance without encouraging care providers to coerce women to have these interventions, because if they don't, their compliance is being measured.
Yep.
And the brochures always also include lovely quotes from happy care providers who say how amazing the bungle is. And here's one quote. So this is about the idea that you bring somebody else in the room to stick their finger up the woman's bum.
Don't make me laugh. So I'm feeling really quite, this is the I'm feeling quite overwhelmed by this, to be honest, right now.
No, this is one of my ranty pants topics, so excuse me for ranty panting on. So this is a quote from a midwife. When you bring the second clinician in to examine their perineum, women seem quite impressed that we want to make sure that we're accurate when we're diagnosing a tear. Like, of course they do, because you're saying we're the external experts. And
well, it's how we package anything. It's marketing. It's spin. So it's like many things in the birth sphere. We can persuade people to follow our expertise because of how we speak and the language we use. And that's a classic example of that. Of course, a mother would feel like, oh my goodness, I'm being so well looked after because they're bringing in an expert to look at me. The fact that for me, what I'm suddenly thinking about as well is this beautiful first, what did you call it? Enchanting hour, which I love instead of enchantment.
Yeah.
So this is the time when she should be actually bringing down those stress hormones. So should the baby. They should be initiating breastfeeding. Hopefully it's undisturbed as much as possible. Of course, a perineum needs to be checked, and we want to make sure that we're doing a thorough job. But we want to do that as quickly, as efficiently, but also as sort of privately as possible, so that that mum and baby can be together and they can start to really let that bonding happen, that beautiful time when those instinctive processes are happening. And occasionally, of course, the baby will possibly be on the partner, maybe be on mum, and she asks for the baby to be held by someone else whilst suturing needs to be done. But again, it's about keeping that space kind of sacred, if we can, as much as possible. But also bringing in an expert when it's appropriate, an expert as in maybe a more senior midwife, maybe an obstetrician as needed. But to be routine to do that is, it feels like we've gone back to the 70s or and before of, you know, every woman needs to be shaved and had an enema, and we don't have any evidence for this. And this is a disturbing practice within birth and within our minds and our hormones and the space we're in.
Yeah. And how can women make so that the brochure is all about, you know, women are not being forced to do this. They've got to have consent, blah, blah, blah. Have a look at this leaflet. And the leaflet has no references at all on it. You know, and as I said, it's all about your chance of severe tearing. Is it all about you and what you bring? If your baby's big, if it's your first baby, you know, if the baby's shoulders become stuck.
So it sounds like fear mongering.
And then, you know,
because that sounds really scary as a woman to see that when you're pregnant, we already have this fear around big babies, in quotes. We're scanning women and we know how that there is that sort of 15% inaccuracy with scans anyway. We know that we're inducing women for big babies. We're listing all these other risk factors. We know that women are getting older having babies. But are we talking about in that leaflet the importance of listening to your body, of getting in a position that's right for you? Is that being emphasized, or are we showing pictures where there's fear mongering and then nowhere for them to access, if they want to, further research upon this, or further, not necessarily the direct research, but further information?
No, the leaflet's grooming. So it starts with, I'm looking at it now, and it has the picture of the tear and explains, you know, which would be terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying.
Explains what different tears are. Then it has a little picture of 100 women, and all of them are grey apart from four are coloured in, and there, that's your chance of having a third or fourth degree tear. And then it's got a list of your chance is increased if, and it's, you know, your first baby, you're of Southeast Asian background, you've previously had a third, fourth degree tear, a big list of all the things that you bring as the risk. And then it has a little, what does this mean? So your care provider will do these things to prevent the risk. And it's the things I've just talked to you about with no references, none. You know, it says helping you have a slow, controlled birth through breathing techniques and without directed pushing. But they're saying you need to control the birth through directing pushing. Even if you're telling women not to push, you're directing their pushing. And using hands to gently support your perineum. There is no references on here. This is just, you know, it's just saying the things that they've said in the bundle, but not supporting it with evidence, which I guess brings me to the evidence. Does it work? So this was implemented in 2018.
So we're 2 years down the track. We should have some stats now.
So initially they were claiming all kinds of, you know, 25% reduction, blah, 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 which I actually pulled apart on my blog. So the brochure and the reporting that's available on their website is from 2019. Now, bear in mind that this is not peer-reviewed findings, and there's no explanation of the methodology, which you would normally have in scientific research. However, the website says that it's preparing for peer-reviewed journals. Now, you can't actually publish in a peer-reviewed journal without having ethical approval, and there was no ethical approval for this. So I don't know how they're going to publish.
Okay, wow.
So there isn't any peer-reviewed published findings anywhere. But what they do say in their brochure, with no explanation of how they're getting the stats, is that for spontaneous vaginal birth, there is 11% fewer tears since the bungle was introduced. So 11% fewer tears, but they don't say of what, just 11% fewer. So if we then think about the overall rate of severe tearing in Australia was 2.5%, and so we're now looking at 11% of 2.5%. I didn't do this math because, as you know, I am useless at math. I have had outsourced this to my mathematics expert, which is not me.
And by the way, that wasn't me that she outsourced it to either. So you're safe with these stats.
Well, please tell me if they're incorrect. I'm sure people will. So what we're saying is we've had, so if we look at the 11% of 2.5%, that's about roughly about this round up to 0.25%. So we've reduced the rates of severe perineal tearing, this is what they're claiming, from 2.5% to 2.25% by implementing the bungle.
Right. Okay.
That's their own stats. Okay. And there is no reporting about episiotomy rates. None.
So we have no idea.
Despite being asked to. No. Anecdotally, there is huge rates of episiotomy now. I'm seeing students who are seeing routine, regular use of episiotomy again.
Oh, God, that just fills me with absolute cold dread. Like, to the thought of, I mean.
So we don't actually, so they're not reporting their full stats. We know that in other, so there's been a little bit of reporting on the European bungles. And what they've shown is that they have slightly reduced the chance of severe perineal trauma, but they've increased episiotomy rates. And if we look at the Australian episiotomy rates from 2018, so the bungle was in place, but these are rates across the whole of Australia, not just the hospitals that are involved with the perineal bungle. And we had in 2018, 1 in 4 women had an episiotomy. And interestingly, of those 1 in 4 women, 42% also had a laceration of some degree. So we're not protecting perineums by doing episiotomy. No. So I'd really like to know what I would be extremely happy if I could just get the stats from the hospitals that are participating about the rates of episiotomy and how they've changed since implementing the perineal bundles.
So these are 28 hospitals all over Australia. Is that correct?
Yes, participating.
And
hospital.
Is there a time point for this participation? Is it like a pilot study to then reevaluate with the research and then we will change, or is it a plan to then implement across Australia?
So there isn't a time frame, it's implementation, and then they're heralding it as a great success. So those hospitals are continuing, and other hospitals who weren't in the initial bungle hospitals are actually picking up on the practices and implementing them as well.
Wow. Okay. But I mean, of course, you're speaking to many midwives through your blog and through your speaking, as well as where you're based in terms of your teaching, and you're hearing that anecdotally, this is on the rise from previous years, having worked with students, having worked within this field of speaking to people. And I know from myself, having spoken all over Australia in terms of lactation, people tell me what's going on. And there's generalized themes that you know, which are pretty common. They come up from every single midwife or lactation consultant I talk to, same with you. And then you start to notice a change. And that's what you're seeing is since this has been implemented.
Yeah, that students are not being allowed to develop these skills of not having your hands on a baby when it comes out. All those things we were talking about in a previous episode of just being with the woman and with physiology, they're not allowed to do that because you have to be doing things now. So we're just increasing the medicalization. And you know, I'm not saying, you know, a lot of midwives are really happy with the bundle, think it's great because they now know what to do. So previously it was like, do you have your hands on, do you not? You know, the guidelines were, it was all up in the air. And now they've got really clear, this is what you do when a baby's coming out.
And everybody wants a framework to work safely. And if it comes from what is seen as an authoritative source, and it's come down through those channels, and it's been, you're given this framework to work under, you can feel as a clinician much safer. And I can totally understand that. But when you've got some more knowledge, or you're in that learning phase or that learning process, and you start to question what's going on, which is what you've done and just spoken about, we're seeing that there is, it seems to be big gaps. And also there's areas that we're just not able to evaluate because they're not reporting on those statistics.
No, and as a registered midwife, you have an obligation to provide woman-centered, evidence-based care. So it's not a, you know, you're in this, and this is why I wrote the blog post, was because midwives were coming to me going, I don't know what to do because I know that this is not supported by evidence. It's not, you know, woman-centered. It's not promoting and supporting physiology. And yet I am being assessed on my compliance with doing these things. So it was really putting midwives into this really difficult situation of, you know, and it's ongoing, and now it seems to be just standard practice. And I need to also, you know, I've had midwives come and challenge me when I've talked about this and say, but you know, it does help and blah blah blah. And these interventions always have their place. And when you're working with a group of women who are having intervention, so I think what we need to be doing with research is actually separating out the women who are having interventions such as epidural induction, because for those women, having hands-on, directing, pushing might actually help. You know, these interventions might reduce their chance of having a perineal tear. They're already having interventions. We almost owe it to the woman to then enact other interventions that reduce the complications that occur because of those interventions.
And we talked about this in the previous episode in terms of intervention with breastfeeding and then having to do something else. Because of the ongoing effects of induction or other interventions, we're in this cycle. You're on that sort of pathway now. So yes, then you're talking about protecting and doing the best possible, but to interfere with something that is physiological doesn't seem to make sense from the research and from what you're saying.
No, and it can cause harm. So I think we need to really be distinctive about when you're caring for a woman who is not having interventions, who's having an undisturbed physiological birth, and everything you do, you shouldn't be doing anything routinely, and everything you do is an intervention. And doing these things that you're told you're supposed to be doing in a bungle are going to increase her chance of having a tear.
Wow, it's a really tricky, complex situation for a lot of midwives out there.
So that was the story of perineal bungles. Kind of a bit of a Brothers Grimm story, I think. Not really a fairy tale, but
wasn't really the story I was expecting with my cup of tea this morning, I must admit. Wow, this is a sort of a scary, difficult, complex state of affairs where we find ourselves in at the moment, and we need to wait for a response in terms of to collect some more research to be able to analyze this efficiently and to make changes that are potentially needed. And, you know, I think that's a general rule of thumb that we all know and practice as, and whether that it's as a midwife or an obstetrician or just in daily life, we are not all the same person. And how many times do you hear as a midwife, not all births are the same, not every woman will have the same birth? I mean, those are basic notions that we know for all of life. We're not always going to react the same. No two children that you have are the same. They don't eat the same. They don't react the same. They don't progress at the same rate. We don't have same personalities. The same with birth. And so they need to be taken more individually. And this approach seems that we have bungled everybody together in this approach, which possibly has detrimental or severe detrimental effects. And it would be really nice to have some further answers on this.
Yeah, you can't dictate to a group of professionals that they have to do a particular thing for every woman without any evidence to support the things you're telling them to do, and with some evidence suggesting that some of it may actually increase the risk for those women. But it, and yet it's happened, and it's just, you know, it's almost like it's been, and everybody's quiet about it now because it's just a normal part of practice.
So what, you know, some final thoughts. What would be your advice to midwives working within this system and possibly women who are being faced with these, this leaflet, this information? What's your advice? Where do we start to go from here?
So I think if we're working with women antenatally, which is ideal, is having continuity of care because you can have these conversations. But even if you can't, you know, is talking, if you are in a hospital where this is happening, women who are birthing in that hospital need to have that information so that they can put in their birth plans. I do not consent to the elements of the perineal bundle. So they need to know what they are and know the research evidence, not just a leaflet saying you're a huge risk here. Your perineum's going to, you know, potentially tear apart because you have these risk factors, and then we can do these things to prevent that from happening. Women need to understand, yes, you might have some risk factors, but also the things that are done to you are risk factors, and that what this bundle is proposing is that we do these things. And what is the evidence for you? For example, you know, if it's a woman who's not her first baby, she needs to know that if the care provider puts their hands on, like the leaflet says, then they might increase the chance that she'll tear, and that by doing the hands-on, they'll increase the chance that she'll have an episiotomy. So the women need that information so that they can opt out and withdraw their consent. So that's one aspect, is having those honest conversations with women about what the bundle is, and that they have the right to opt out of that, because they do. And the bundle says very clearly that women can, you know, withdraw consent. They can not have this bundle. So women need to know it's an option and that they can opt out, and it needs to be documented. And then look, in the clinical area, it's really difficult because, you know, it's easy for me. I made a decision a long time ago that my integrity was more important than being liked, which means that I'm not liked very much, but I do, that I know that what I'm, because I knew that the times when I walked away crying from work was not about, it was when I did things I knew were wrong because I wanted to please other people and not. So for me, I would be, I just refuse to do it personally, but I understand that a lot of midwives don't feel they're in a position to just refuse to do the bundle. So again, it's about ensuring that women are fully informed and consent to the bundle before doing it. You know, how many midwives get consent before putting their hands on the woman in the perineum?
Good question.
So I haven't got an answer for you. I just feel like, you know, we need to, what I'd really like to see with midwifery is some really strong solidarity and standing up for each other in the clinical area and for women. So standing up for women and backing each other and standing up for women. Yep.
Absolutely. I think those are great final words in the situation that we're currently in, which is really highly complex and difficult, because it's, as you say, we can look at it as black and white, but actually it comes down to the sort of the practices within the hospital, the type of hospital you're working in, the colleagues you work with, and it comes down to, at the end of the day, that we're informing ourselves, we're upskilling, and we're also standing by each other, and we're learning from each other, and we're listening to each other.
But I think we also need to acknowledge, though, that the systems are set up to literally get compliance. You know, they even use that term, to get compliance from midwives to do the things that the system wants us to do. And depending on where you work, the culture supports midwives to actually do with woman midwifery, and other cultures really do not. And if you step outside of that, you are bullied. You know, yeah. I've been there. You are vilified. It makes your life really difficult. So, you know, I think as midwives, we just need to keep having these conversations and voicing our concerns and supporting each other.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. I'm trying to bring this together, but I think I'm just really quite shocked and appalled, and I feel really quite hurt by what's happening to women and also to midwives, because I can imagine myself being in that space and not necessarily feeling like I've got the strength to always stand up against it. And I feel it's a really difficult place to be in right now. So I think what you're saying is brilliant, that we bring ourselves together, that we inform ourselves. And I'm really glad that you've brought this story up today.
And can I just also add that we, as midwives, and this doesn't just apply to perineal bundles, or it applies to everything. It's about looking at where your sphere of influence is, because we all have one, even a student midwife, and her sphere of influence might just be that one-on-one with that particular woman. Yes. Right now, the words that she says. Yes. To that woman is to, my sphere of influence is I can do research. I'm quite good at ranty panting, and you know, put my ranty pants on and stand on my podium and have a little go. I don't mind doing
it's
that.
All right. I get my ranty pants on when it comes to lactation, so, and postnatal care. So I'll get my chance. Don't you worry. It's only fair that you have yours.
So we all have spheres of influence, small, big, different, across different areas. And you just need to work within that and do what it is that you can in the sphere that you can operate.
I think that's enough of your storytelling for now. I'm not sure I want you to tell any more stories in the next few times, but I think this is an important one that we have talked about today. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Midwives Cauldron podcast. For more episodes, awesome discussions, and topics which get you thinking, sign up on your favorite podcast host. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at The Midwives Cauldron, as well as share it with your friends. Let's get this stuff out there, wide and far. So until next time, I'll leave you with a few extras to roll us out on the credits. Like, really just put a downer on my day.
You won't ask me to tell a story again, will you?
I'll never bloody ask you to tell a story again. Jesus.
So I'll never get a job in research in government funded initiatives.
Never. Holy shit. You better not interfere with my career, mate.
You're tainted by association.
Yeah, thanks. Brilliant.
There's nothing wrong with causing trouble, Katie. If you're not causing trouble, you're not doing anything worth doing.
Right. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.